So I'm Barry Logan. I'm a professor at Mason State College in Grand Junction. And just a couple of things I want to mention before we start. And that is, I guess I'm most comfortable when I'm in front of a classroom where my students interact with me. And so I'm not comfortable just being up here and telling you what I think. And so, you know, I'll have stuff to say and things to show, but I will turn to you throughout the presentation and ask you what you think, and I'm interested in your comments and observations, so please, you know, feel free and to do that. Also, thank you for coming on the wee hour, right? It's been an early session. You guys are troopers. And also, traditionally I have a pet peeve with people who read their slides, but I feel compelled to do that to a degree because of the people who may or may not buy the tape. Sorry, I did this Mac sound. I thought it was melting. And so, you know, please put up with that. Again, it's not for you, it's for the people I'm listening. And so, my interest in this topic grows out of two things. One, I was teaching a class on, it was called Difficult Texts. At my college, and so we were reading the most difficult things that we could possibly find, Finnegan's Wake, The Wasteland, Book of Revelation. And there's one point where we were, you know, reading chapter 9, and we had this passage, and so, again, those of you too far away, I would encourage you to come forward. If you have good eyesight, you can read it. But what was interesting is as we were discussing this passage, I was asking my students how they made sense of this. And a student says, oh, well, those locusts are really helicopters. And this forecasts the last days. You know, and I look at that and I think, well, I guess in a kind of visual way, a locust or a grasshopper could kind of look like a helicopter. And I thought that was interesting how she could take that passage out of context. You think, well, if that's the case, then we are like in day 5 of the apocalypse and have been for a long time. And I just found that odd. The other kind of motive behind my interest in this is, you know, for years and years and years, I've heard general authorities, you know, cite passages from either quote books or more recently they seem to, at least as far as the sources go, original texts. And the more I learned about American literature and American history, which is kind of my specialty, I thought, that's really odd that Brother So-and-so would cite this person when they seem so, when their beliefs are so antithetical to the larger Mormon project. And so I started poking around a little bit. And so that's my interest in how I got started with this. And so I think, well, why do we cite, right? Sometimes we cite because people say things better than we possibly can. It lends this authority, right? This is particularly true, for example, in the medieval period, right? You don't really have, say, writers wouldn't assert their own personal authority. They always got their authority from, esteemed figures or scriptures. And of course, we use cite and quotes as textual evidence. And just a quick example of this, where we have someone like Maxwell in 2003, and brothers and sisters, the cast of players on this planet for whom the revelations and translations are so pertinent, includes those who, in that familiar phrase, are living lives of quiet desperation. They have now been joined by those living lives of noisy, slurping indulgence, wrongly celebrating their capacity to feel, so that they finally lose their capacity to feel and become past feeling. A real Maxwellian phrase. And so, in this particular case where we have lives of desperate or quiet desperation, you probably recognize and say, oh, it's Thoreau, it's from Walden Pond. And in this particular case, it seems as though Maxwell is not interested in Thoreau at all. It's just the phrasing that he likes. And it goes back to my, you know, one of those reasons where, well, Thoreau says it eloquently, Maxwell borrows that, but he's not interested in Thoreau per se. And I'm interested in other more interesting uses of citations and stuff like this. And if we look at where that phrase comes in the larger context of Walden, it doesn't, or you can see that it really doesn't help Maxwell out either way. Right? It's just wedged in there as a beautiful line and nothing more. And what's interesting when we talk about the phrase out of context, we often say we find that a violation, that you can't do that. We always go back to this idea of a proper context or its original context. And I want to complicate that idea a little bit. I want to get out of Mormondom for a few minutes and talk about an example that illustrates what I'm talking about. And so in 1981, there was a documentary photographer who took this picture of the Sandinista rebel throwing this Molotov cocktail. You can't see it very well, but it's right in his hand. And it was actually a Pepsi bottle, and it matters in a minute. And so he became known as Molotov Man. And so this photographer, I put this up on the web, a decade or more later, Julie Garnett saw that photograph, right? So you can see. And so she created this painting for a series that she was creating of humans in extreme situations. And then what was interesting about that is then it proliferated in all kinds of bizarre ways. And so on the one hand, you have, where they would use the silhouette of this man in South America, and it had a political context. It would show up on T-shirts, though. It would show up at the anniversary of the revolution. And most, I guess, problematic is it shows up in a Pepsi ad. Right? So here's the guy, here's Molotov's analyst, the painting version, and it's your revolution. And it's this beautiful example of co-optation, right? Here you commodify revolution, right? You revolt by buying Pepsi instead of Coke or something like that. And so we can understand why some people get nervous. So on the one hand, the photographer writes, there's no denying in this digital age that images are increasingly dislocated and far more easily decontextualized. Technology allows us to do many things, but that does not mean we must do them. Indeed, it seems to me that if history is working against context, then we must, as artists, work all the harder to reclaim that context. We owe this debt of specificity, not just to one another, but to our subjects with whom we have an implicit contract. But then Joy Garnett responds, says, does the author of a documentary photograph, a document whose mission is in part to provide the public with a record of events of social and historical value, have the right to control the content of this document for all time? Should artists be allowed to decide who can comment on their work and how? Can copyright law as it stands function in any way except as a gag order? These remain open questions for many people. There was a blogger named Zucca, however, who posed what has for me become the central question on all of the activities surrounding Molotov. Referring to the lone figure of that Sandinista rebel, the person writes, who owns the right or the rights to this man's struggle? And I find this example helpful in that, can Thoreau, for example, with Maxwell, can Thoreau own the rights to Walden Pond forever? Can no one ever use that, poach that in any kind of way? And so we could go on and say, because my idea is rather than talking about taking passages out of context, let's talk about recontextualizing them. So instead of talking about it in terms of orphans, that we find new homes for these passages. And then therefore, we should, or it can give us, or in that act of recontextualizing, then it's productive as well as potentially disturbing, because it gives it new life and meaning. So a quick example is just, examples of collage. You might be probably most familiar with Barbara Kruger's stuff. But these are, good examples of people who have taken photographs, paintings, artwork, documents out of context, and recoded them, gave them new life by putting them in new situations. And so as a result of that, I think we've got to talk about contexts, not context, that a text or an action participates in multiple contexts simultaneously. Right? Second, I think there's countless contexts. And two ways to think about that would be that if contexts are framework, then we can multiply the number of frameworks. for example, we could look at the Sunstone presentation or a conference in terms of a literary framework, psychological framework, sociological framework, historical framework. We can just multiply those, and we get new ways of seeing the conference. Also, contexts are bound by time. You can easily see how we can expand that. Right? So do we look at Sunstone in the context of 21st century, or do we look at it in the context of second half of the 20th century? Do we look at it in the context of skepticism of the 20th century? Right? How far do we go back? And so, arguments about the proper context, I think, are far more complicated. And so that's why, my intent as we look at some talks by general authorities is not merely to say, well, look how they took these things out of context and distorted it. Well, that might be true, but I'm also interested in how they enliven those passages and the implications. And so we get to the point where we, instead of talking about proper context, we talk about it, or we ask instead, what's the effect of this particular act of recontextualizing? Does that make sense? Any questions or comments? Okay, well, there'll be more for you to say in there. So I want to start off with this conference talk by L. Tom Perry. So, somewhat recent, right, 2008. So he begins his talk by explaining that his family was stressed out in the Boston area, so they went out to Walden Pond. And then from there, he says, from his experiences at Walden Pond, Thoreau determined that there were only four things that a man really needed: food, clothing, shelter, and fuel. I would like to expand on each of these four needs of life, as well as the spiritual benefits of a simplified lifestyle. And so, then, of course, the original, where that comes from, is Walden Pond, in this first section called Economy. And so this is Thoreau at this point now, not Perry. So it would be some advantage to live a primitive and frontier life, though in the midst of an outward civilization, if only to learn what are the gross necessaries of life and what methods have been taken to obtain them, or even to look over the old day books of the merchants to see what it was then most commonly bought at the stores, what they stored, that is, what are the grossest groceries. And so I'll let you read this one on your own, so you probably get tired of me, but you can get a sense of what Thoreau is interested in, right? And it's not spiritual issues, right, in the sense that we're used to. I'll give you a second to zip through that. To talk about stuff that's completely different, right? So for Thoreau, then, right, food is to keep us alive, or what he calls fuels the fire within. Clothing keeps us warm, shelter keeps us warm, fuel keeps us warm and cooks our food. But then for Elder Perry, right, the discussion of food leads to a discussion of obey the word of wisdom. Clothing is a launching pad for a discussion of modesty. Shelter becomes a morality lesson on materialism and debt, and fuel then becomes a way to talk about spirituality. So before I move on, any of your observations on that shift from Thoreau's four necessities to Perry's four necessities? Yeah.
For me, it seemed like Thoreau was trying to get to the nitty-gritty of things, and he was trying to go as deeply into the minimalist, yet in the talk, it seems like he's expanding instead of going minimalist.
No, absolutely, yeah, because this seems to complicate the issue rather than simplifying things, right? And so we have, rather than reducing things to the four necessities of life, we have food taboos, right? We have codification of how we should dress and act, and there's economics, right? It gets really complicated, ironically, right? Other observations? Yeah.
Well, I think you have to consider the purposes of the authors, too. Perry had a completely different idea in mind when he used these four examples than Thoreau did. Thoreau is purely a pragmatist in the way he treats them. Perry is taking them to another level and adding his own meaning to them, his own interpretations.
No, true. And then it's interesting, I think we need to ask, well, why use Thoreau in the first place? Right? Why couldn't Elder Perry tell us about word of wisdom, modesty, economics without Thoreau?
Well, it's an appeal to authority. Okay. It's appealing to somebody who's well known to Perry's audience and is thought of as a purist and somebody who lived a simple life. So Perry knows his audience would be familiar with why Thoreau is famous. Right. But Perry's purpose is not to get people to go out to camp and find out what it's like to live off the land. Perry's purpose is to raise people to a more spiritual level in his.
Right. I think he's also using it as a rhetorical device to get people interested. You know, like he used a joke to begin to talk. If I'm sitting in the audience and he starts talking about obeying word of wisdom, I'm starting to zee off and think about basketball players. But if he starts talking about Thoreau, I'm thinking, oh, this is a little unusual. You know, not many general authorities talk about Thoreau. I'm interested. So he hooks me that way.
Yeah.
I think it can also be a way of kind of co-opting the emotions behind what Thoreau is writing. Like, for example, in General Conference, when the women get a talk to address to us, it's almost always like, calm down, you know, you're doing great, you don't have to stress about all these tasks we give you, and so this could be a way of sending a message of the tasks they want us to do in a way that's not overwhelming, because it comes in wrapped up in this Thoreau simplicity nature message.
No, that's good. So a couple other things about Thoreau, we'll move on. But see, you know, these passages are taken, and admittedly, in a sense, out of context, from other passages from Walden Pond. Let me give you a second to zip through those. Uncomfortable in the sense of it seems as though, or I'm not sure if Elder Perry is being fair with Thoreau because they seem interested in completely different projects. And I should say completely different projects, but the idea of Thoreau being firmly rooted in this earth, and he's interested in the earthiness of humans and encouraging us to identify with the rhythms and cycles of earthly patterns. Whereas it seems Elder Perry is interested in moving us beyond that to more spiritual and abstract realms. So at least one conclusion I can draw from this is then Thoreau becomes a spokesman for Mormon values. Right? As someone said, we co-opt Thoreau. And not that he becomes a Mormon, but he seems sympathetic, a fellow traveler with our cause. And then, on the other hand, it seems as though the potential problem is that Thoreau undermines Mormon foundational beliefs. Because Thoreau certainly, I guess I would argue, that he celebrates the tangible, the earthy, and the secular. Also, within Perry's talk, he has this great little quote. Just before Thoreau died, he was asked if he made peace with God. He replied, I was not aware that we had ever quarreled. Another Perry cites this very sympathetically, again, to kind of show arguably, Thoreau's spirituality and his relationship with God. And what's also interesting is Elder Perry borrowed that quote from this particular book, Vive la Repartie, which puts it in a completely different context, right? The witty quip in your deathbed, you know, saying. Here, we'll skip that for a second. What's also interesting is during the same deathbed moment, other accounts that Elder Perry did not include, was part, someone had asked Thoreau in same moment, are you ready for the next world? Which Thoreau replied, one world at a time. Which again, seen in that larger context of Thoreau's attitude towards spirituality, that he doesn't really seem interested in you know, this future life, right? It's like, I'm rooted to this earth. Any final observations before we go? Yeah?
I'm encouraged to hear, you know, talking about some other topic instead of a Mormon writer, so that you get truth in some other place that isn't Mormon. And so that encouragement to read these and find what it means for your life. It gives you a permission to kind of interpret what it means for yourself. And if you're allowed to interpret this other context, it also sort of gives me a permission to interpret scripture for what it applies to me.
So permission in that if Elder Perry does that, then that gives you the... Okay.
Or not permission or model or something. You know, okay. This is how it can be done.
Okay. And I'll return to that at the end of my presentation, but I think it's a great insight.
But on the other hand, if you are a fan of Thoreau and you read it, you'll sit there and say, did he really read this and did he understand what he read? So there's that too.
No, that's true, yeah.
Well, the problem I have with it is at some point, if you start doing that, the text becomes meaningless. You can superimpose whatever you want on Thoreau, whether it be atheism or Mormonism or, you know, or fire prevention. I mean, I think Thoreau meant something when he spoke it. I mean, you know, as readers, we bring our own interpretation to the text, but there has to be some sort of boundary there. Otherwise, you know, what's the point?
Well,
I mean, there's like a serious co-opting going on, and there's got to be something at the point which, you know, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, and I think that's a great way to articulate the fundamental question is, are there boundaries? And how do we know when we engrave them? And, you know, as we mentioned, you guys were just a couple minutes late, right? And
yes.
You weren't here for the discussion of Molotov Man?
No.
Oh, okay.
I missed that.
So they have, we don't have to review that, but that question of boundaries, what are the boundaries, how do you know, who sets those, who gets to say? So we'll go on to another one, right? So Elder Oaks, in a recent talk. So what I've done here is, this is Oaks's text, as he has cited Lewis, but then my strikeout shows what was in the original Lewis that Oaks took out. So I get for our listening audience, I'll go through this. Lewis explained his teaching of the Savior. Quote, the moment you have a self at all, there's a possibility of putting yourself first, wanting to be the center, wanting to be God, in fact. That was the sin of Satan. And that was the sin he taught the human race. Some people think the fall of man had something to do with sex, but that is a mistake. What Satan put into the heads of our remote ancestors was the idea that they could be like gods, could set up on their own as if they had created themselves, be their own masters, invent some sort of happiness for themselves outside God, apart from God. And out of that hopeless attempt has come the long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. Right? And so Elder Oaks cites this sympathetically. And then right after this, Lewis writes, the reason why it can never succeed is this. God made us, invented us as a man invents an engine. Obviously, Oaks uses Lewis to drive home a point about selfishness. But what do we do with the fact that Lewis's theology rejects core doctrines such as eternal self, divine heritage, divine royal potential, among others? And so people joke about Lewis being the 13th apostle, right? And you go to your bookstore, for example, and it's Lewis, right? You can get anything you want by Lewis. And he's, other than Lincoln, I think last year at Sunstone, someone pointed out, other than citing Abraham Lincoln, C.S. Lewis is the most widely cited non-Mormon in conference talks. So what do we do, right, with someone like Lewis, where does making Lewis a fellow traveler Mormonize Lewis? Or by making this move, does he transform Mormons into mainstream Protestants? I mean, what do you think? What is it? Yeah?
I don't know. It seems like in a lot of the talks, they are kind of trying to push away from the things that make us
unique. All the things we're going to kind of like avoid any talk about, like, can we mother, becoming God, all the things. It's kind of like that's kind of all being pushed under the rug because we want to say, oh, well, we're focused on Christ. We're like other Christians. We are a Christian. And it's like they seem to care more about being, you know, considered, you know, part of the in group than actually, you know, sustaining what people have, you know, been, you know, trying, going across the plain and dying for years. It's like, and I'm not sure if that's, you know, what they really intended, but it does seem in a lot of talk that they're kind of saying, well, you know, yes, all those, you know, peculiar things we have, those are, our peculiar teachings, those are wonderful and great, but, you know, let's kind of keep that out of sight so that we're, so we can be accepted. And I'm not sure if that's, you know, because we're just wanting to feel like they are more a part of society and connect with people, or if it is, you know, just trying to become, you know, more mainstream, you know, in reality. But it does seem that a lot of the quotes they're doing, a lot of the things, they are kind of trying to push away from us being, you know, unique and just strange and peculiar people and things. So,
so the effect then, if I understand you right, the effect of citing Lewis would be a way to make us less peculiar?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Other ideas? Yeah.
You may have already covered this in a couple minutes before we came in, so, so I apologize. But
you didn't miss that.
look at this example and the previous example. I keep coming back to this thought that I have frequently in church, at the risk of sounding like Stanley Fish, which is, you know, is there a text at this church?
Mm-hmm.
John 4 seem to be making the same moves with these quotations that you're showing that they make with scriptural texts. In other words, you know, there appears to be some meaning or intent to scriptural texts, but they use them in a different context or even out of context to illustrate or mean something else. The assumption is that because they have authority, because they are presiding, that the text means what they mean it wanted to mean. And they seem to be doing the same thing here, right? You can sort of take Thoreau, you can take Lewis the same way you would take Jeremiah or Abinadi and use it to your own purposes to illustrate what you want to illustrate. The paradox for me is that frequently when we talk about text in church, we're really committed to the sort of very formalist, textualist, even originalist sort of agenda, right? We want to look at the literal meaning or the plain meaning of the scriptures. But while we're doing that, we play the kinds of games with it, the authority games that you're pointing out. And I think people who are citing these authors would be very offended if someone did that ostensibly with scriptural text.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. So there's a disconnect here, right? You know, we're sort of looking for God in the intertext. And there's some background assumptions about authority and how you use text that haven't ever been really surfaced.
No, that's good. So, there's something that your comment I wanted you to say. So any other ideas before we switch? Yeah?
I think that it actually does both. Because on the one hand, there is this big push now to make us seem part of the Christian world, notwithstanding that our past history and rhetoric soundly denounced the entire Christian world as apostate. And now we want to be part of that group that's apostate. But I think there's also a very strong impulse in Mormonism that wants to make all good people of the past into Mormons that can then be baptized for the dead, and in the next world they're going to be Mormon.
Okay. And just to piggyback on that idea that, you know, we're certainly reminded that Mormons are interested in truth wherever they find it, right? And that particular move is interesting. So if you say, well, this particular passage by Lewis, right, is a bit of truth that Oakes pulls out. I'm sympathetic with that cause, right? But at the same time, I think, well, there's so much of Lewis that just rejects, right? It repudiates what we think. How do we deal with that? you prompted me to say. I think a really good subtle example is someone like the Book of Matthew, right? Where there's a constant saying, well, this is a fulfillment of this particular Old Testament passage. And so taking, you know, the Torah and then putting it in or recontextualizing it, giving it new life and meaning. And so I'm not saying this is a new practice, and I'm not saying it's a bad practice, whatever. I find it an interesting one. And so, again, the Book of Matthew is a good example, and there's certainly ones that predate him. So this one I find interesting, where so Alexander Morris shows up in an ensign, but the context of his talk was quite civil, right? He's at the Utah League of Cities and Towns. And so this is his talk, right? Some there are in shriller voices who proclaim the ideas of morality and goodness have no place in the formulation and execution of public policy. I remind those of that view that the founders of this nation knew otherwise. They understood that private morality is the font from whence sound public policy springs. Replying to George Washington's first inaugural address, the Senate stated, "We feel, sir, the force and acknowledge the justice of the observation that the foundations of our national policy should be laid in private morality. If individuals be not influenced by moral principles, it is in vain to look for public virtue." And of course, I mean, we're all familiar with the project of turning founding fathers into proto-Mormons. So when I talk about that, complicated. So this one is the original, right? This in that letter to Washington, you get the sense where that passage was taken. So what is in red is what Morris borrowed. So you can see a slightly larger context. I'll give you a chance to read that. And I think what's interesting is, as I show more slides, that I think we can safely say that the founding fathers were interested in virtue. But it's slippery when we go from virtue to church-going Christian, right? And that's always the move that seems to be made. And so we have that. I mean, do you find anything particularly egregious about Morris's borrowing of this particular passage? Seeing did they ruffle your feathers or make you flinch at all? Yeah. And so later on in Morris's talk, he cites Adams. I will skip a bunch, and then at one point he says, against that somber and darkening background, these words of John Adams, the second president of the United States, ring with special force. Our Constitution was designed only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other. So to kind of hold that on, we'll juggle several things here. Then that particular passage comes from this larger text. I won't have you read this one. There's nothing particularly noteworthy. I don't think you would flinch if you read the whole thing. And then later on in Morris's talk, he cites Washington again, saying, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Gap, let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Gap can't be the providence has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue. And so what's interesting is, here we have three sentences strung together that seem coherent, that seem like they belong to each other, when in fact, so this is the original, and I've struck it out, right, those gaps, right, those ellipses, is what you can see where they come from. And so we get these other passages, and there's nothing, I mean, as you read through that, there's not a whole lot. Again, it doesn't seem as though Morris is being disingenuous to the quote. Right? It doesn't seem to be distorting it, although he's using it piecemeal. So what I want to do now is say, well, I want you to think about those passages that Morris used in a larger context of not only deism, but continental philosophy, but the same claim, or claims by those same foundational figures. And so we have someone like Thomas Paine, right, founding father. This postdates the revolution, but we get him saying, of all the systems of religion that ever were invented, there's no more derogatory to the Almighty, more unedifying to man, more repugnant to reason, and more contradictory to itself than this thing called Christianity. We have Ben Franklin, right? This is my creed. I believe in one God, created the universe, that he governs it by his providence, or providence, that he ought to be worshipped, that the most acceptable service we render to him is doing good to his other children, that the soul of man is immortal and will be treated with justice in another life respecting its conduct. In this, as for Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, this is a letter to a friend. I think the system of morals in his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see, but I apprehend it has received various corrupting changes, and I have with the most present dissenters in England some doubts as to his divinity. You have Washington, that never mentions the name of Jesus in any of his letters, and he left, apparently, according to one historian, attended church service, but left for communion, or before communion. You have Adams, and I find this one particularly interesting. Right? St. Adams, who was talking about virtue and religion earlier, right? It will never be pretended that any persons employed in that service, forming the U.S. government, had interviews with the gods, or in any degree under the influence of heaven, more than those that work upon ships or houses, or laboring in merchandise or agriculture. It will be forever be acknowledged that these governments were contrived merely by the use of reason and the senses. 13 governments thus founded on the natural authority of the people alone, without a pretense of miracle or mystery, are a great point gained in the favor of the rights of mankind. Or Jefferson, at one point in a letter to Thomas Cooper, says, we may safely affirm, though contradicted by all the judges and, sorry, should be writers on earth, that Christianity neither is or ever was part of the common law. You'll know that Jefferson created his own Bible, in a sense, by taking a literal razor blade, goes through the Bible, takes out all the miraculous parts, but he keeps kind of the moral teachings. Patrick Henry did want to have this phrase, the plan of Jesus Christ, inserted, and he opposed that. Let's see, another one. Let's see, James Madison, religious bondage shackles and debilitates the mind and unfits it for every noble enterprise. I'll let you read the second one on your own. So, another one. We'll skip that. Let's hear that. So the question then, or the reason I bring this up is, you know, we talk about founding fathers as bastions and defenders of Christianity, but then when we look at these other passages that are in that larger context, right, it seems to trouble or unsettle those claims by Morris. And so we think, well, were those founding fathers really proto-Mormons? Were those founding fathers Christian? Did they want to instill Christianity in those foundational documents? And so by looking at that larger historical context, I think it unsettles Morris's claims, or at least the impression. So ideas on this one, on this idea of founding fathers and these competing passages by Franklin, Madison, and friends. Yeah?
Well, with Franklin, he made a practice in Philadelphia of donating to every faith that set up a church. And it wasn't because he believed in that particular faith, but he made a point when he met with his friends, where he had his little intellectual circle every week, of saying that he believed that religion's purpose was to be a guideline and to help men reach their potential, and that it didn't matter so much what their particular doctrines were or anything, but that it was to help them develop virtue, which was the concept to him. It wasn't, and religions were just one means to an end, but it interests me because he's used a lot in quotes about being so Christian, and he was Christian in the way that he helped his fellow man a lot, but he wasn't. Not in that sense. He didn't pick any particular faith.
Okay.
I saw
another hand. Yeah.
It does disturb me as you go on, because at no point do any of these these speakers purport now go and read more and understand.
Okay.
And so, you know, I'm left with a sort of soundbite and think I know now. So they've got some knowledge and think they know what is.
And admittedly, right, you should be suspicious of me as well, right? Because I'm pulling passages out as well, right? I try to give you fuller context, right? But I can't give you everything. I mean, I would say one benefit or one goal of my presentation today is hunt down those footnotes. Read the entire documents by yourselves and see that, right? Do your own homework. Because that seems to be the next step. Yeah.
Actually reminds me of a speech last night where she talked about how all religions need history, especially new ones. And they try and hook into what is already there. And I think it's definitely what's going on with the LDS people, but it's also going on, I think, with political movements. Certain type in this country, they want desperately to have a history, and so they're trying to hook their own political philosophies back to the founding fathers,
okay,
and saying, look, we have legitimacy, we have this history, we've been here forever, and so we are right. Just sort of like, you know, how the LDS people are hooking into the founding fathers or the Israelites or anything else. So
that's good. Well, and Tea Party movement is exactly,
yeah, that's
the perfect example of that. And so this one comes from, well, running out of time a little bit, so pick up the pace. But so from Elder Hunter in 1973, so I'm going way back. Again, we seem to love those transcendentalists, right? So we go back to Emerson. And it's interesting about this one that we have, you know, his citation of Emerson, which reads, "It is my duty to say that the need was never greater of new revelation than now. And how many churches, by how many prophets, tell me is man made sensible that he is an infinite soul? It is the office of a true teacher to show us that God is, not was, that he speaketh, not spake. Men have come to speak of. Revelation is somewhat long ago given and done as if God were dead." Right? It sounds as though Emerson, even though this is post-Restoration, it sounds as though he's like, well, you know, obviously we need a restoration. You know, don't be dismayed when you see the amount of text. I'm not going to ask you to read it all. But so these little passages, I want you to just give you a visual look of how they're poached from certain paragraphs. So the first one comes in the middle of this. Then later on in the essay, then this one, you'll find this one, right? And then in the middle of another one, it gets this. And so I didn't count the pages, but it's like over 10 pages, there's single sentences pulled out. Now, as a literary scholar, this makes me really nervous, right? But this seems like bad form. But putting even that aside, there's one more. Then, if we look at another passage from the same sermon that Emerson is giving, then we have this one, right? That, again, I won't read the whole thing, at least the top part in the red. "And now let us do what we can to rekindle the smoldering, nigh-quenched fire on the altar. The evils of the church that are now, or that is, are manifest. The question returns, what shall we do?" So, and then this is the punchline, right? Here's Emerson's idea. "I confess all attempts to project and establish a cultus with new rites and forms seem to me vain. Faith makes us and not we yet, and faith makes its own forms. All attempts to contrive a system are as cold as a new worship introduced by the French to the goddess of reason. Today, pasteboard and filigree, and ending tomorrow in madness and murder. Rather let the breath of new life be breathed by you through the forms already existing." And so this one, I guess I want to say that he wasn't playing fair. Right? That, you know, on one hand, I can be sympathetic with other kinds of poaching, you know, for the reasons we've discussed, but here, even within the same essay, we have a repudiation of creating something new. And of course, if you're a reader of Emerson, you realize Emerson is far more interested in you, right? In your own ability, in your own divinity, than finding external stuff. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know the answer to this, and maybe the people who came around the Wasatch Front and live here more than I do will know the answer to this. I used to work on the Judiciary Committee. We knew more or less what the senator wanted to say or what his positions were. And we would write these speeches and talks and questions for committee hearings and whatever. And he would see them, literally he would put them in front of his face. And you know, we were the ones who went out and found the quotes and found the, you know, the whatever. And I don't have a sense to the degree to which general authorities have staff. And they say, you know, I need to give a talk on public morality, or I'm doing something on the restoration. Can you find me some good quotes from one of those transcendentalists that I can pepper up my talk with? And you know, they may or may not be responsible for the ellipsis and so on. I mean, it's still sloppy, and I still flunked one of my students who did this. But mechanically, a lot of times when you see this in these types of texts, it's the result of the process, and the process had to do with staff, and staff were sort of goal-oriented rather than context-oriented.
No, I think that's a great insight, right? And that they probably reached the same state with Bateman in that, and the plagiarism issues.
Yeah.
I was saying, well, did you write it or not? And like, well, I mean, that was interesting. And so as far as culpability, I think you make a good point in terms of who's responsible. But at the same time, we can't deny the fact that the public face on this is the general authority, right? And there's a certain kind of authorship in the sense of authority, right? Or that the general authority authorizes this by sticking his name on it.
Yeah, no, I very much agree with you. I guess my overall point is, you know, when the president or senator or a public official, in my experience, speaks, they're sort of the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean,
right. They're
really speaking for a constituency, a staff, you know, a bureaucracy that sort of is behind that. And sometimes the public doesn't realize that, but, you know, but frequently that they're sort of the point person for something larger to go on in the organization. And it'd be interesting to know the extent to which that's true of general authorities as well. Which, you know, I mean, they are sort of, as you said, the face, but something the tip of the organizational iceberg. And I'd be curious to know what's going on, you know, under the water that produces particular results. Whether it's the, you know, textualism that I talked about earlier, or the type of use of quotations you're talking about here, or other sorts of odd, what looks like anomalous results.
No, I think that's a great observation. Yeah?
Well, I don't know all the dispute that might be true. It really concerns me because I think of politicians, I think of the most slimy, hypocritical, dishonest kind of people I can imagine. And I hate to think of apostles being that way. I think they have an obligation in a situation like that to instruct their staff about honesty. I mean, I feel like that particular quote is way beyond that.
I would agree with most of that, including the slimy part. Sort of seeing the other side of the rock. But again, my observation is a little bit different. Going back to, as my spouse said, what Jan Schutzman said last night about organizations, you know, about, you know, that churches don't flourish until they develop a bureaucracy, right? And this may be an indicator of a certain stage of maturity of our organization, or a certain type of bureaucratic development that organizations have to survive. I mean, we might not like the form it's taking, and we might not like exactly how it's being executed, but it may be indicative of some of the things that she was talking about.
Well, it's absolutely indicative, and it's absolutely frustrating. I mean, I've seen this happen where, take away from your point, obviously, it's very brief, but when you look at what happened to Prop 8 in California and the argument, the statements were taken entirely out of context, and the church leaders saying, oh, well, we just commissioned somebody at a local level to do that, and you know, that's not our fault. There's got to be some responsibility in my opinion.
Yeah, and my final example, and thank you all, I find this really interesting and good. The final example is come from Elder Holland in 2004. So he writes, anxiety and expectation regarding the need for divine direction is not uncommon among those religious reformers who set the stage for the restoration of the gospel. One of the most famous of the New England preachers, Jonathan Edwards, said, it seems to me, and these be all brackets, is Holland's work, seems to be an unreasonable thing to suppose that there should be a God that has so much concern for us, and yet that he should never speak, that there should be no word from him. So you look at the original, and it kind of makes me nervous, real nervous. So I kept in red is Holland's work, and then what I struck out was the original. And not only is it a kind of patchwork, but We have even, if we go back, we have stuff like from him, and the original was no word of his. Right? There's, again, I could say, I dare say I might flunk Holland on this in the way that he's inserting words in the original rather than merely just poaching. And so this kind of patchwork makes me nervous. And this would be a case where we're, I think we can talk, I think, more confidently in saying, well, right, we're not playing fair. This seems to be taken out of context.
I have a comment.
Oh, please.
There's another thing, though, that conference audiences do not have the benefit of seeing the ellipses in print either.
Right.
And so, as far as they know, it's all one smooth, unbroken quotation lifted from the original source.
Right.
And so that seems like another kind of strike against the whole honesty of this.
That's true. And to their credit, right, that they provide the sources, you know, in the at least printed version, right, that they were helpful and there was no deception.
Yeah, the printed version is legitimate, but delivered from the pulpit.
No, I think that's a good point, yeah.
But what about that attitude that America is here and was founded in preparation for the Restoration, that if challenged like this, if you were to challenge the writer of the talk, that they would say, well, I was simply calling out the truth that they had at the time and took out the misguided part because through my prayer and my reflection on the quote, those were the areas in which he was misguided and I called out the truth for us to hear.
Maybe. I mean, with Elder Holland, I would say, you have a PhD in literary studies. Yeah. If you really do this and your dissertation.
But if you said yes,
my respect for Yale would go down there. The same thing where, here I'll skip this. There's another passage where he quotes Roger Williams, quoting Cotton Mather, talking about Williams. And again, it's another kind of patchwork of, you know, pulling out what he needs, inserting things, right? I mean, it's strange, right? Where Mr. Williams. Then he, you know, Holland deletes quickly, and then he replaces quickly with finally told them, his followers, that's more fair game, that being himself misled, he had misled them. And again, I guess I'm mystified by this kind of tinkering with the passage. And so, a couple of things. One, right, he uses these quotes to suggest that there's something American about the desire for revelation. Uses Holland and Edwards to suggest they were preparing for the Restoration, even though there's anachronistic problems going on. It's also hard to believe that Edwards is interested in ongoing revelation, where, right, as a good Calvinist that he was, he wasn't looking for extra revelation. And the idea that Edwards' view of humanity, if you've read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, we realize that we're all a bunch of worms that don't deserve much. And so the idea that we're sharing the same bed with Edwards kind of strikes me as odd. And so, on the one hand, so a couple final insights, and I'll be quiet. So the act of putting Emerson and Edwards on the same context as Mormonism perhaps reminds us that Mormons embody both Calvinism and Transcendentalism, right? That we celebrate external authority as well as the divine self who needs no mediator. And for me, this is one of if I had to pick a paradox in Mormonism, so this is it. Our somehow simultaneous embrace of external authority and internal divinity. And I thought Holland can pick no better examples than Edwards and Emerson to represent that. I thought that is so beautiful in its economy, right, of telling us about ourselves. And also linking Romanticism, Transcendentalism, Revolutionary War discourse, among others, it empowers as well as limits us, right? That these discourses become part of our gospel vocabulary, but we understand Romanticism, Transcendentalism, and the Revolutionary War in Mormon terms. One last comment, and this probably goes back to something you said earlier, where, you know, we claim to value purity, doctrine undefiled, right? But yet, and then we're encouraged in countless manuals to say, stay with LDS materials. And then what's interesting is those so-called LDS materials are contaminated by the very text that we use to clarify those gospel insights. And so Again, the very act of citing others by the purveyor of security are the ones who contaminate the very gospel principles. And I find that just fascinating beyond belief. And yet, at the same time, I don't fault them, because I think it's absolutely inevitable. The idea of citing, poaching, borrowing, building on, responding to, we can't get around them. Right? And I love this passage by John Muir. Right? I'm going to pull him out of context. This idea that when one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world. And at least the way I'll co-opt that would be, you look at a talk in General Conference, and you tug at a thread, you know, that one in General Conference, and all of a sudden, it leads to the rest of the world, right? You tug at Holland's talk, and you get transcendentalism, you get Calvinism, you get continental philosophy. And so it's interesting that you could say, well, when you prepare your talks for your lessons and discourses over the pulpit, you could say, by all means, only use LDS materials. But what that really means is the whole world is open to you, right? Does that make sense? And so, going back to what you said, they model us, right? The general authorities have given us a model to say you can poach from all kinds of things. And then my final comment is, my presentation is an invitation for you to hunt down those sources. Look at those citations in not only the textual context where they came from, but think in the historical context. The text where it came, the body of work of that particular author, the milieu and the larger historical context of that as well. And it's fascinating what we find. So thank you for coming. And any other comments or observations before we head off?
Well, one thing that bothers me, that a general authority like Holland will bastardize a thing, and then he'll stand up there and say, quote, and then he'll read his thing, and end of quote.
Okay, so the questionable honesty issue?
Yeah, I mean, he's quoting something he made up.
We didn't make it up, right?
Seriously, edit.
Yeah.
Well, there's monkeys with typewriters too, but I don't know. To me, when you were talking about, you know, the transcendentalists and the Calvinists, etc., if you were a general authority standing up in front of the church and being the spokesman for all of this, I'm wondering if the reason they would change things and take things out of context is to make sure that we absolutely got the right message with no ambiguity. Which, you know, bothers me in and of itself, but, you know, we are members of the church, and the leaders are very much, I don't know what you would call them, control freaks. On message, very much on message. And so if you're going to something like this and they're going to pull from Calvinism, they're going to pull from something else, I'm wondering if there's sort of a paranoia about themselves, like, I've got to get this message right, there can be no ambiguity in the flock. Just like, you know, how many earrings you can wear, what color your hair can be, when you can wear a beard, when you go, you know, be an officiator of the temple. It's all sort of part of making sure the message is structured within the Mormon Orthodox framework, and that's why they make it.
And to piggyback on that, I find it interesting that we love the transcendentalists, and there's all kinds of good reasons for that, right? And it's interesting that we don't hear many citations from continental philosophy, right? We don't cite from Hume and Rousseau and Locke and Hobbes, right? I find that interesting, even though they might be fellow travelers in a weird way.
Well,
right?
Also, the fact that the general authorities are probably in America rather than
right.
Now, so we're all French.
Yeah.
I'm curious if there's a way to comment on literature outside of maybe formal literary criticism in the same way that you referenced in the visual arts with the Molotov Man. Because I find, like, for example, when it became a Pepsi ad, the original obviously informed the Pepsi ad, but I don't know necessarily the Pepsi ad informed the original. The original could still stand alone. Whereas when we hear some of these quotes in conference, the Thoreau quote, for example, I think even if we went back to Thoreau, I think the Mormon context we would have would inform his text. It would be kind of
that
reciprocal.
Yeah,
right. So I wonder if it's truly analogous, or if we need to Like if it, like if it's possible to comment on another writer's work in a way that doesn't contaminate it outside of, you know, actual literary criticism.
I guess my short answer is no, but I guess I don't find that to be a problem, right? Because as I mentioned at the beginning, I think it's not productive to talk about things being out of context, that it's recontextualized and it has new life and we look at the effects. And so I guess I have no problem with that mutual contamination, just that we're aware of it. But I think it's so inevitable, and I think it can be healthy as well as limiting. I mean, that's why I like the phrase that we are both empowered and limited by this kind of practice. It's not either or. You know, we don't need to say, let's stop doing this. That's not my object at all. It's, let's recognize that this is really helpful and productive and potentially inspiring. But at the same time, it's potentially limiting and dishonest and other things. Does that make sense? So it's that nuance that I'm interested in, because I grow impatient when people say, oh, you took that out of context. And it's like, so what's your point? Right, as though that itself is a bad thing. I think it's not, per se. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how to say this, but what bothers me is the teaching that we should proof text everything instead of a sense of finding your own truth, the understanding within yourself, what sounds right to you. Let's go out and look at what's been written and tell you what it means. And that's sort of the practice that bothers me.
Okay.
You know, that we have to find, okay, we have to justify baptism for the dead, so let's look at this little, you know, 1.5 thing out of the New Testament.
Right.
And so we have to proof text everything. This is where it was written, that this is proof.
No, that's true. And that goes back to an old practice, right, of gaining authority and using this textual evidence, and perhaps again problematic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is it part of trying to normalize ourselves, where they're kind of sending this subliminal message out there that, oh, you know, people out there think we're weird, but we can quote some of the greatest thinkers of all times, theologians that are, you know, quite universally accepted and taught in the highest universities in the land, and they agree with us more.
Well, I think that's part of it, right? And again, for me, that's another paradox in terms of, like, on the one hand, we're very empirical in the church, but at the same time, we can reject empiricism completely. But I think we have to go, but thank you so much. You have been.